question that we have right now is, what role, if any, has the U.S. government played in helping to facilitate the departure of maybe not all, but some of these students?
Of course, the most what this brings to mind is after 9/11, it was President George W. Bush at the time and private planes picking up the bin Laden family in various places in the United States and spiriting them back to Saudi Arabia. That does it for today's program. We will link to Shane Dixon Kavanaugh's excellent reporting at The Oregonian. He broke the story on the Saudi students fleeing the U.S. justice system, possibly with assistance of the Saudi government. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a full-time, one-year paid news production fellowship. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time chief engineer. Applications are due by midnight on Monday, March 4th, to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, or by emailing engineerhire@kboo.fm. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regards to the minimum qualifications and by answering the following question: why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. In honor of Engineers Week, Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering features a panel of six local women of color engineers talking about their career paths and answering questions. The panel is moderated by Cheryl Norris. Again, that's Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. It is a couple minutes past five, and coming up next we have KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Gazelle Consulting, providing HIPAA compliance and IT security services to businesses throughout Portland and across the West Coast, including HIPAA consulting, software and risk assessments, and trainings. More information online at gazelleconsulting.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler pushes back against the Portland Police Union, calling for an investigation of text messages to a right-wing group.
Residents of Southeast Portland report an increase in attacks and harassment of LGBTQ-identified Portlanders.
And teachers in Oakland prepare to go on strike for better wages and working conditions.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 20th, 2019. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Emily Gresham Beamer. KBOO News would like to issue a correction for a story we aired on February 6th. We stated incorrectly that Portland Police Sergeant Greg Lewis was the officer who killed 17-year-old Quanis Hayes 2 years ago this month. In fact, it was Officer Andrew Hurst who fired the fatal shots that killed the teenager. Sergeant Lewis was not present at the killing of Quanis Hayes. But just days after Hayes was killed, during a roll call with Portland police officers, Sergeant Lewis said, quote, "We should go out and kill black people." He later claimed that the comment was sarcastic, but his termination letter, issued on January 12, 2018, said that his remarks shocked and left a negative impression of the officers and sergeants who were present. On February 6, 2019, the Portland City Council voted to provide Lewis with $100,000 in back pay, to settle a claim filed by the Portland Police Union. As for Andrew Hurst, who killed Quanis Hayes, a grand jury cleared him of any wrongdoing, and he's still on the force. But the family of Quanis Hayes has a pending lawsuit against the city of Portland and against Officer Hurst, saying that his use of deadly force was unwarranted.
As of today, there have been at least two reported attacks targeting LGBTQIA-identifying people in Portland. One attack involved a trans woman in Portland who was brutally attacked from behind with a baseball bat, another with a rubber hammer. These attacks stem as far back as June of 2018 when two people, a brother and sister, were attacked after the annual Pride Parade in downtown Portland. Tiny Tose of the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer has stated that he will create an anti-gay movement in the area.
Can't wear my Trump shirt somewhere? Try to rip it off. And you're going to get your teeth knocked out. You're going to be treated like a f***er.
These attacks have been reported to the Q Center, a local nonprofit organization that works to provide resources for LGBTQIA community members. The Q Center will be holding a meeting to discuss the concerns of the community on Sunday, February 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. For more information, please contact the Q Center at 503-234-7837.
Two former legislative interns filed a civil lawsuit today in the Marin County Circuit Court against Senate President Peter Courtney, former State Senator Jeff Cruz, Legislative Counsel Dexter Johnson, Legislative HR Director Lori Christopher, and the State Legislature in the State of Oregon. Senator Cruz was forced to resign in February 2018 after several women, including State Senator Sarah Gelser from Corvallis and Elizabeth Steiner Hayward from Portland, filed sexual harassment complaints against him. Both of the women who filed the lawsuit, Adriana Martin-Witt and Ann Montgomery, were law students when they interned at Cruz's office. They alleged that Cruz's behavior was well known in the Capitol. Meanwhile, several state legislators are filing a bill to establish a legal privilege of confidentiality for both those who report harassment to the proposed legislative equity office and those who are the subject of the complaints. Nigel Jacques from the Willamette Weekly said the bill would protect lawmakers from a repeat of the public embarrassment suffered when then-Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian released his findings in January that exposed the widespread cover-up of sexual harassment in the state capitol. Senator Gelser and the other survivors of Senator Cruz's harassment were opposed to the bill, saying that the bill would, quote, protect perpetrators.
A new report released today by the Southern Poverty Law Center found the number of hate groups active in the U.S. rose to its highest level in two decades last year. The count of active groups the civil rights organization labels as espousing hate climbed to 1,020, up from 784 just 4 years previous. This was propelled by an increase in the number of white supremacist hate groups across the country.
Portland Mayor Tad Wheeler says he will continue the city's investigation into the exchange of text messages between a Portland police officer and the founder of the right-wing Patriot Prayer Group. The announcement comes after the Portland Police Union filed an official complaint against Mayor Tad Wheeler, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, and the Commissioner Chloe Udaly. The complaint says that Mayor Wheeler has quoted, quote, failed to develop an understanding of even basic police work. The union filed complaints with the city's Bureau of Human Resources, alleging the statements by the elected officials violate a rule that prohibits workplace harassment, discrimination, and retaliation. The allegations come after Wheeler, Hardesty, and Udaly called for an independent investigation of police communications with far-right groups. The Patriot Prayer Group claims it is not extremist, but its members have been filmed making white supremacist statements, attacking people on the street with weapons, and shooting guns at protests. The man who killed two police in Portland, Max Train, last year, was a frequent attendee of the Patriot Prayer events.
Greater Portland Now, an intersectional feminist chapter of the Oregon National Organization for Women, is organizing carpools to Salem tomorrow. They are hoping to bring supporters of upcoming House Bill 2625 to the 1 p.m. hearing. House Bill 2625 would require law enforcement statewide to direct more resources to investigations of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Oregon. The hearing is expected to run from 1 to 2 p.m. If you are interested in attending, contact Greater Portland Now through their Facebook page.
Oakland teachers are planning to strike on Thursday following what they saw as a successful strike in Los Angeles last month. They want a 12% raise in smaller class sizes. The district is offering a 5% raise. The California report from KQED has more on this story.
In Oakland last night, teachers and union leaders got together at a church to plan, figuring out, for example, where to put students whose parents don't want to cross the picket line. So why go on strike? I put that question to teacher Misha Kiomra.
Part of why I'm out here is I don't know if I can afford to stay in the district with the current contract and the current pay rate.
You mean to live here or to work here?
To live here on my salary. And then also for my students, we have really crowded classrooms. I had 29 kindergarten first graders last year. It's really hard to get learning accomplished with that many kids in a room.
And there is a wide gap between the 12% raise Oakland teachers are demanding and the 5% raise the district is offering. So it's looking likely that these teachers will spend their Thursday on the picket line instead of a classroom. We're going to head now to the Central Valley, where teachers are keeping a close eye on developments in Oakland as they consider whether to follow their lead. The California Report's Alex Hall picks up our story from there.
Fresno has some of the worst performing schools in the state, according to a recently published list from the California Department of Education. And that's contributing to teachers' frustrations in West Fresno County, who want higher wages, smaller class sizes, and support staff like counselors and nurses. The last meeting between their union and school district officials was scheduled for last week, but the district canceled the day before. The same thing happened about 20 miles north in Madera. Teachers there are now at the fact-finding stage, the last step before they can legally declare a strike. In the meantime, in both Fresno and Madera, union leaders say the schools are losing teachers left and right, and the instructors replacing them have less experience. West Fresno teachers are set to meet with the school district again next month. For the California Report, I'm Alex Hall in Fresno.
Okay, so let's step back for a moment now just to understand how certain schools up and down our state got here in the first place. To do that, we're going to rewind four decades when California voters passed Proposition 13. KQED's education reporter Vanessa Roncagno is going to take it from here. So Vanessa, take us back to when Prop 13 was passed.
So back in the late 70s, when Prop 13 went on the ballot, housing prices were going up fast, and they were going up a lot. And at the time, the way property taxes worked, your house was reassessed every year and your rate went up if the value of your house went up. So there were all these horror stories about longtime homeowners losing their houses because they weren't able to keep up with their property taxes. And so Prop 13 was really pitched as a fix for that issue. And it passed in 1978 with overwhelming support. Two-thirds of voters supported it. And it radically changed how property taxes work in the state.
And thereby how education gets funded throughout the state.
So property tax revenue plummeted in the state. It went down 60% in the first year after Prop 13 passed. And that had a huge impact on school districts across the state, which relied at that point primarily on local tax revenue. That was 60% of their funding.
And what did this do in, say, a school district like the one that you live in Oakland?
In my neighborhood, for instance, two neighbors might pay radically different taxes. One person might be paying like $1,200, say, based on what their home was worth in the 1950s when they bought it. Their neighbor who just bought the home that's worth, I don't know, near $1 million might be paying $14,000 a year in property taxes.
Is there a push to overturn Prop 13?
Yeah, one of the most significant efforts looks to change how commercial properties are taxed because they also benefit from Prop 13. And commercial properties don't necessarily change hands as much as private properties. This moves to have them reassessed every 3 years. Prop 13 has long been considered untouchable. So the fact that people are looking to even change the commercial piece is really a big shift.
Vanessa Roncagno, education reporter here at KQED, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next week, the Portland School Board will consider sharply reducing overseas trips for students in language immersion programs. The district has expanded its language programs in recent years, implying that they promote equity. However, some of the programs, such as Japanese immersion at Mount Tabor Middle School and Mandarin immersion at Hosford Middle School, tend to serve more affluent students. The board is currently examining how all of its expenditures can help decrease the gap between higher performing upper class students in Portland and lower performing schools in working class neighborhoods. The trips, costing an average of $3,500 per student, are paid for by an outside source. But parents also make donations and organize fundraising events.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO. And at 6, it's Say It Out Loud. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, listen to Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather will have a 20% chance of rain, with patches of fog and freezing fog, and a low of 31. Tomorrow's weather will start with some freezing fog, becoming cloudy and then clearing, with a high of 46. Today in history, in 1992, John Singleton received an Oscar nomination for Best Director of his first film, Boys in the Hood. Singleton was the first African-American, and at the age of 24, the youngest person ever to be nominated for Best Director. The quote of the day is from rapper and actor Tupac Shakur, who, along with Janet Jackson, starred in Singleton's second film, Poetic Justice. "Somebody help me, tell me where to go from here, because even though thugs cry, but do the lords care?"
"2018 was a record year for campers at Oregon State Parks, with nearly 3 million overnight visitors. Add in the people who visited state parks for the day without staying overnight, and the total usage totals over 54 million visitors. Although summer months have always been busy for state campgrounds, spring and fall crowds have been growing significantly. State Parks spokesman Chris Hovel explained that the peak time is getting longer and longer, and the camping season is increasing. The biggest increases were at three coastal parks, Fort Stevens near Astoria, Newport's South Beach, and Bullard's Beach just north of Bandon. In the face of this growth, park officials are considering fee hikes to pay for increased maintenance as well as future park expansions.
And now it's time for today's report from Native National News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
Native News, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tweet by President Trump has led a Native American group to encourage Congress to rescind medals awarded to soldiers more than 100 years ago after the Wounded Knee Massacre. Roz Brown has more.
Four Winds Incorporated urges Native Americans to become involved in the political process and voter engagement. Co-executive director O.J. Simmons says the president's tweets mocking Democratic presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts perpetuate disdain for Native Americans that has led to their marginalization in our society.
What is happening by the president using Native Americans as racial slurs takes back everything that we've been trying to show to our people is a positive reason to participate in the political process.
Trump repeatedly has called Warren Pocahontas after she claimed Native American ancestry. His tweet said her recent TV ad should have been filmed at Wounded Knee in full Indian garb. Letters from Four Winds were sent to the House and Senate Armed Services Committees requesting that language to rescind the medals. It's estimated that 20 soldiers were awarded Medals of Honor in 1890 after killing 250 Native American women and children. Siemens says the genocide of Native Americans should never be used as a political pun.
It's a horrific insult. Basically walking and laughing over the graves of our ancestors that were murdered.
The Four Winds group is planning a trip to Washington next month to knock on congressional doors.
The massacre at Wounded Knee, of the killing of the women and the children, and those individuals receiving medals of honor set the tone of how Native Americans are treated throughout the United States.
I'm Roz Brown.
Maori delegates composed a haka and gifted it to South Central Foundation, an Alaska-based healthcare organization. KMBA's Trip Krause talks with one of the delegates about their relationship with Alaska Native people.
You're hearing a traditional Maori dance, or haka, that's likely 19 years in the making. It was performed in collaboration with some Yupik traditional dancers and was composed by Maori delegates from New Zealand. Nurupatu Kimura Maipai Campbell said that the relationship between the Maori and South Central Foundation began with his grandfather.
About 19 years ago, when my grandfather and a few other members of our community traveled to Alaska to find other indigenous initiatives or health initiatives around the world. And so he had heard about a story of the native people of Alaska assuming responsibility of their healthcare system. And so as I was a kid, my grandfather would talk about this amazing work that's happening in Alaska. And as I got older, I got the chance to come here.
2 years ago, South Central Foundation CEO and president invited the delegation to attend the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention.
To share our culture, not only to share our culture, but to also hopefully inspire the youth, the Native Alaskan youth, to inspire them in the sense that, being Indigenous and Native is the most unique, special thing.
In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
Attorneys for Kentucky Covington Catholic High School student Nick Sandman have filed a defamation lawsuit against the Washington Post, seeking $250 million in damages. The student was at the center of a viral video with Native elder Nathan Phillips during a confrontation in Washington, D.C. in January. In a web post Tuesday, attorneys wrote, "This is only the beginning." The paper told reporters it's reviewing the lawsuit. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Senate Republicans are aiming to cut debate time for most of President Donald Trump's judicial nominations to just 2 hours, down from 30. Last week, on a strictly party-line vote, the Senate Rules Committee ushered through a package that would allow the Republicans to speed up their already rapid pace of nominations by slashing the time needed for debate on judicial nominees. And today, a new proposal by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will rapidly increase the pace of district and circuit judicial confirmations in the coming weeks, months, and years. This comes during a historic remaking of the judiciary, in which Republicans have pushed through 30 federal judges to sit on the U.S. Court of Appeals in just the first 2 years of Trump's presidency. That's compared with the 2 judicial seat nominations that occurred under the last 2 years of the Obama presidency. Federal appeals courts, which hear challenges to district court and federal agency decisions, are the most powerful courts in the nation, excluding the Supreme Court. In 5 of 12 circuits, more than 25% of the judges were appointed by Trump and ushered through by McConnell, according to an analysis by Lambda Legal.
Facebook is in negotiation with the Federal Trade Commission to settle charges for massive privacy violations of its users. The agency could force the social media giant to pay billions of dollars in a record-breaking settlement. The FTC is investigating whether Facebook violated a 2011 settlement. That settlement required Facebook to receive user consent before sharing their data or making changes to it. The company has also agreed to audits for the next 20 years. Since March 2018, when it was revealed that the data of up to 87 million of Facebook users was shared with a political consulting firm, Cambridge Analytica, through exploiting the Friends of Friends feature, the agency has been investigating the company's role in this privacy breach. The fine could be in excess of $2 billion, which could be the largest fine ever levied by the FTC against a private corporation.
Nicholas Sandman is suing the Washington Post for $250 million. Sandman is the smirking MAGA hat-wearing teen who stared down a Native American protester in D.C. last month. His defamation suit accuses the Post of, quote, targeting and bullying, end quote, Sandman, as part of the newspaper's, quote, ongoing campaign against President Trump, end quote. This morning, Trump tweeted his support of the lawsuit after earlier tweeting that the media has never been more dishonest than it is today. Trump also made a threat against the New York Times this morning on Twitter, calling the paper the, quote, enemy of the state, end quote. Sandman's family chose the $250 million amount because that is what Jeff Bezos spent to purchase the Washington Post in 2013.
While condemning Iran for developing nuclear weapons, which Iran denies, the Trump administration is considering selling nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia. A handful of Trump supporters would reap massive profits from this plan. Elijah Cummings, the Democratic chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, announced an investigation into a White House proposal to help Saudi Arabia build dozens of nuclear reactors. Without safeguards, the U.S. technology could help the kingdom develop nuclear weapons. Despite the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, the Trump administration has continued strongly supporting that country, including large weapons sales.
A Portland chapter of the Junior League has taken on the issue of sex trafficking of minors. KBOO's Emily Gresham Beamer has this interview with Di Bledsoe, chair of the Stop Human Trafficking Committee with the Junior League of Portland.
I'm speaking today with Di Bledsoe, chair of the Stop Human Trafficking Committee with the Junior League of Portland. For the last 8 years, she has actively engaged the community at all levels in strong calls to action with a focus on collaboration. Her committee coordinated Connect PDX in partnership with Abolish Now, hosting a collective impact conference with 70 participants from 46 organizations on stopping sexual exploitation of girls and women in Oregon. This year, they launched PDX Best, a community-wide initiative that will engage business leaders through awareness and engagement in partnership with Multnomah County, anti-trafficking agencies, and trafficking nonprofits. Welcome, Di.
Why is your work so important? Thank you so much for having me. And I think this work has been incredibly meaningful to me personally, as well as the members of the Junior League of Portland. You know, about 10 years ago, we had no idea that this issue was even happening in our community. And how it all began was I was a brand new member in the Junior League, and our president at the time came into a meeting and informed us of this. And it was really a huge shock to me personally, as well as other members. And after the meeting, I went up to her. I just felt so incredibly compelled. I just couldn't believe it. I went up to her and I said, you know, I really would like to be involved in anything that you guys are doing, or, you know, count me in. And that's how it started. And it was a group of really five members in the Junior League, just kind of this ragtag group of women. We became fast friends, and we went out into the community and learned everything we could that was going on with this issue. And that was 10 years ago. A lot of things have changed, and we've done a lot, but this issue has remained one that I personally feel incredibly committed to. It's very meaningful, and this work will always be, you know, very close to my heart.
As of your knowledge, is your Junior League chapter the only Junior League chapter nationally exploring this issue, or is this an issue that the Junior League has taken up nationally?
So that's a great question. So we are not the only Junior League that is focused in this mission. We were one of the earlier Junior Leagues to adopt this cause. But since, you know, over the last 10 years, several leagues have really taken notice of this and have done some strong work. And our parent organization, AJLI, which is Association of Junior Leagues International, has also launched a national campaign, abolishmovement.org. And it's an incredible campaign that they've, you know, launched in the last month. I'd suggest anyone check it out. It's a great awareness campaign that will give you a real sense of the issue.
Was it easy to find these stories, or did you really have to dig deep in the Portland community to find these compelling stories?
You know, when I first learned that sex trafficking and human trafficking was going on in our community, it was a real shock. You know, 10 years ago when we heard about this, it sounded like something from, you know, a bad movie. Like, mm-hmm. It was hard to imagine that minors were being sex trafficked in our backyard. And some of the horror stories that we've heard, you know, since then, I literally just couldn't believe it was going on. And then the more you got into it, and then as we learned from other experts, we knew that we had to do something. This is one of those issues that's nonpartisan. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you sit on, what your religious affiliation is or lack thereof. Everyone can agree that sex trafficking of a minor and otherwise is wrong. And so it's one of those issues when you hear about it and you learn about what's really going on and it's happening right in your backyard, you can't help but feel absolutely compelled to take action. And that's how we started. We just decided this is not acceptable in our community. And while we may not be able to do everything, we can do something and we can do our part. And that's what got us started down the path.
Has your strategy evolved over the years since you first were inspired to take up this work? Or did you sort of have a game plan from the beginning that you were able to stick with?
Yeah, so we took a giant step back in terms of our efforts because, and this is a good thing, when you learn about this issue, you want to jump in immediately and do a million things. And it's really tempting. But we also recognize that there were other agencies and organizations out there who were already doing really important and significant work. And so instead of duplicating the efforts of other agencies, we went out to learn what they were doing. And so once we were able to piece together the different efforts in our community, we then could take a step back and say, all right, these people are doing this. What's really needed in our community? And for the Junior League, you know, we're a women's volunteer organization. We are not service providers. You know, we're not qualified to work directly with survivors. We're not law enforcement agencies, and we're not, passing laws, right? So we knew that we couldn't do certain things. But what the Junior League is really good at is collaboration, organization, facilitation, and really what we're known for is bringing people together. And that's what kicked off our initial collaboration conference way back in 2012, is we recognized that there were a lot of groups out there, and because it was so early on, not many of them knew of each other or even what they were doing. And so that was our first step, was let's bring everyone together so they can meet each other and learn what's happening, you know, over here.